Welcome to Catholic Stuff You Should Know, the J10 Initiative.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. Father John here with
Father Jacob. Second to last?
Second to last, down from the mountains.
Yep.
Another harrowing drive, early winter storm coming through.
I shouldn't admit it. I was kind of hoping the storm was worse so I would have an easy decision.
Yeah.
And then it was kind of one of those storms where the roads definitely are slick. More things can happen. I was more worried about something else happening in front of me, closing I-70. The canyon closed for about an hour and a half from like 7:30 to 8:30, 8:45 or so. And then I'm thinking, I guess I'm not getting down. And then the canyon opened up and I was like,
there you go. Well, we are safe and sound here in Denver, Colorado. A chilly morning. It was felt like 9 degrees is what the temperature said at 5:30 when we got in the cold plunge. So,
40 degrees and 9 degrees air temps.
Yeah, 42 in the tub. It was a little chilly. I thought that the lack of sleep and the excessive caffeine would be balanced out. And a good homily would happen at the morning mass. No. It was just as lame as usual. So, but it has been a beautiful few weeks as we've kind of come into early winter here in Colorado. For those of you who don't listen to the podcast or who might just come into this, sometimes we presume you know what we're talking about. Father Jacob lives 2.5 hours west of Denver in a place called Glenwood Springs, Colorado.
Yeah, I've got to go up through, the modern engineering marvel of I-70.
Right.
Which cuts through the mountains and then through the Glenwood Canyon. So I've got three treacherous points to traverse.
Yeah.
Glenwood Canyon, narrow canyon. So if an accident happens, there's no way to get around. You're just stuck.
Yeah.
If you're in the canyon when it closes. And then there's Vail Pass, which is a relatively steep pass, especially climbing from the Vail side.
Yeah.
And then that drops down into Silverthorne, Frisco kind of basin area. And then you climb up to the ever treacherous Eisenhower Tunnel.
Yeah, which is more psychologically treacherous, I feel like, because if you get locked in there. They closed the Glenwood Canyon 3 years ago for mudslides when I was on that side, and I was going to pick up my car by Grand Junction and get back for a wedding in Vail. This is Chris and Addie White. Addie listens to the podcast. She was one I was just telling you about before of when we talked to our friends, and they're like, what have you been up to the last few months? And then you're like, blah, 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 I'm into the cold plunge. And they're like, we've heard all about that. And then you're like, yeah, we did this. And they're like, heard about that. And you're like, okay, let's talk about you. But it was great to see Addie and Chris. But it was one of those things where...
What route did you have to go to get around?
I had to go way north.
Okay.
So I stayed the night in Grand Junction and then drove through Meeker.
Yep.
All the way around.
Yeah, it's funny. You can be on Google Maps and you can look at traffic and say, oh, it's 3 hours and 5 minutes to Denver from Glenwood. And then 10 minutes later, you opened up and it's 6 hours and 32 minutes to Denver.
Routed
through Steamboat.
Oh, man. Yeah, well, this will come out, I think, right on Thanksgiving. And then we're right into Advent here. And the new year begins. As you know, we do this rotation of the guys. And so I think you and I are kind of rounding out our time here. We're going to record with all the boys next week.
Yep.
We have what's called Villa every year in the Companions. Those longtime listeners know about this, but every year we have several annual commitments together. One is a summer conference, which we do in the beginning of August, and then one is called Villa, which is a phrase we stole from the Jesuits, which is basically just like vacation together, which is usually after Christmas. But we're experimenting with a pre-Thanksgiving few days together.
I'm excited about it. I think it's a good time. I think it'll work for the schedules a little bit more. So I don't know.
We'll see.
There's a little less of the snow sports activity.
That's the problem. All you have is some of the mountains are open, but it's like the one run of death. That's your one option.
Yeah, I think Aspen in November. Snowmass are opening on the 23rd.
Okay.
I think. But,
okay.
Yeah, Villa. It sounds like we're sitting around with our pinkies up.
Villa.
We're here at Villa.
Yeah.
But the populist young companions movement have come and ruined Villa for you. There's too many of us to find a place during Christmas season in the mountains. So.
Exactly. Well, yeah, there'll be a finger up, but it won't be a pinky finger while we're playing
volleyball.
Volleyball. I wish you were playing volleyball. It's going to be stupid board games, which I I just get throttled in twice a year by Matt Book, the 51-year-old child, man-child board game
at
enthusiast.
At least you give him one game a year. It's a sacrificial offering for you.
I don't even know the rules. Like, we're playing viticulture, and like, you can't do that. And I'm just like,
I'm going to go for somebody a smoke. Explain? Brady, play for me.
Yeah, exactly. Let Brady play for me. Right. So, anyways, it's another semester has gone flying by here. This is my sixth year in the seminary, which is crazy to think about. You've been ordained. You're out. You've been out for 6 months now.
Yeah.
So, pretty wild stuff.
I walked back in the seminary this morning, and I was I'm not normal here anymore. So it was, everybody was seeing me. They're heading off to class, and everybody was double taking.
Yeah,
like probably deja vu. they're freaking out because they think that they like went back in time.
Yeah.
A year, and they all have an extra year of seminary.
That's right.
They're freaking out. It's
a time warp. He's back. Don't let him come back. Yeah. Okay, so I have to throw another friend under the bus here as we get started. I was talking to Adam Greiner last night. He's on the board of John Paul the Great with me. I had my last board meeting with John Paul the Great High School, which was amazing. It's been a great few years of getting that thing off the ground. But Adam Greiner is one of these. Do you have these friends like, you need to be more like Bishop Barron, like this, and then like this? And you're just like, the guy is like, one take, Barron just can just go, and I mean the amount
he's
of
super good. I mean,
it's ridiculous. So, anyways, I was like, yeah, "Bro, I'm never gonna be. We're never gonna be like Barron. Okay, yeah, just get over it."
I try my best, but when I do that, it's because I'm stealing everything from Bishop Barron to somebody who's walked through my office door,
right?
And now I'm just representing Barron to them.
Exactly, exactly. And he was like, "Yeah, you and Machado guys are you guys are pretty deep thinkers." And I was like, "Yep." And tomorrow's going to be, we're going to go deep.
Yeah.
So this good topic is, we're going to go out with a bang because this is what you and I do. And it's you know,
I'm buckling up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like last week's was kind of fun for me to talk with you about the podcast, but afterwards I was like, man, that's not one of my favorites.
The metaverse. Yeah. And a quick shout out to a fellow podcast, host of ours, Father Mike Rapp, the dark horse of all dark horses athletically. He looks like Paulie Bleeker from Juno, and he just did an Ironman.
Sub 14 hours.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. So, and I saw him. He was walking through here yesterday. We were chatting, and I was like, you were just...
And he was still smiling. He's the photo afterwards. He's still chipper.
I know.
Chipper Father Mike.
So, incredible. Incredible work. Congrats to Father Mike. But we're not talking about Ironman. We're talking about Ferdinand Ulrich.
Ulrich.
Do you know Ferdinand Ulrich?
I do not, except for via quotes from you and Jonathan Francois.
Okay, so the Humanum Academic Press, which is connected to John Paul II Institute, is putting out his collected works. The first one was Homo Abyssus, which is his kind of deep metaphysical kind of groundwork, which I bought, and then I panicked, and I never read because I got really scared because he's very, very dense. So I started with three short works, which I just read the last few weeks. And the last of the three short works is the topic for today because it's a fascinating and interesting one, Prayer as the Fundamental Act of the Creature. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Prayer as the Fundamental Act of the Creature. But just a quick word on Ferdinand Ulrich. Who is this guy? He is a Catholic philosopher who taught at the University of Regensburg. He is Czech by birth, but I think German Catholic, born in 1931. And he just died. He died in 2020. So he's recently, he studied and taught in Munich, all over. The way that I know about him is through Hans Urs von Balthasar.
Okay.
And then through other friends who... are either at the Institute who are reading him or people in that kind of communio circle.
1941, and he's born in Czechoslovakia? 1931.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, Czechoslovakia, but he was German.
Lived through World War II as a boy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he, very interesting thinker, very deep, and basically what Ulrich's project is to do Thomistic metaphysics, but engaging modern thinkers such as Heidegger and Hegel. So if you're saying, well, what do all those words just mean? So metaphysics is the study of being, being as being. It's the highest form, highest science of philosophy. We forget that we've talked about this before, the Greeks discovered being as a reality. But with the Christian revelation of God, being was understood more deeply in ways that we unpacked that we couldn't understand. And that came to a really beautiful synthesis in Aquinas. And then the whole thing unraveled as metaphysics was refashioned or even kind of eclipsed. Yeah. So we live in a modern world that's really not interested in being at all. Mm-hmm. And again, there's a number of kind of reasons for that, and that's not particularly what we're talking about. But there was a metaphysical crisis at the core of the modern project, which is where we find ourselves. And people don't think about being. They think about action. This is Marxism, right? It's always about just the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. Do, do, do. It's mm-hmm. not about what is a being and what are natures and what is creation. That's all been kind of eclipsed.
Yeah, the classic Aristotelian Platonic action follows being.
Right.
Thomas picks up that we can know the natures of things because we observe their actions, but the actions point back to the being itself that yeah. is the one doing the action. Action, apart from a being, doesn't really make any sense. But
yeah. So that is metaphysics, roughly considered. Thomistic metaphysics is really the framework that it's the best possible framework we have as Catholics to understand reality, the reality of the incarnation. Yeah. It doesn't, no system grasps the reality of things. God's self-disclosure, God is not a system. But this is certainly the deepest and most penetrating way into the mystery that God has disclosed. And I think the interesting thing about Ulrich is that he's really faithful to St. Thomas, but he's developing Thomas's thought. Mm. And he's developing it in such a way as he's really engaging Nietzsche and Heidegger and these guys. And Balthasar loves that, very influenced by Ulrich, who is and his philosophy, because they have a shared sense of, like, we have to engage modernity. And we've yeah. talked about this a million times, where it's like there's a real divide right now in Catholic world of, like, is it all just going to hell, has gone to hell, and just forget it? Like, there's nothing good to engaging Marx or Nietzsche or these guys. Or is it like, this is fundamentally broken and flawed, but this is the state of the world, and we need to understand it. And there's mm-hmm. there's also developments here. There are things, there's positive developments in modernity. It's not just all of it was just trash, you know?
Yeah.
That's a huge... That affects how you do everything in Catholic life. That fundamental question, I think.
Yeah.
How do you engage the world?
I find it fascinating that since time immemorial, we've had apocalyptic literature, we've had crisis literature, we've had literature that kind of tries to understand major historical events kind of in their place. And I think the fact that we have classics from the Iliad to contemporary literature that... When you read a book that gets to the nature of man, you realize that there's not a lot of new ideas. It's just kind of repackaging of the ideas in the way. So I think that the modern project is kind of an attack on this metaphysical principles and what is being. But because of that, we kind of have regressed in our knowledge of God or thinking of God. And now we've got this kind of vague spiritualism.
Right.
That people are the atheist, proposition has kind of started to fall away. There's not a Christian, Judeo-Christian God in a lot of people's minds, but people are looking for aliens to find meaning or hope. People are looking to, just general vague spirituality, spiritualism, rise of occult practices, again, kind of an entering back into paganism. And I think there's just a fascinating cyclical, cultural philosophies that kind of come and go. And yet the human person, going back to that nature, the human person seems to still pierce through, through the through line of history, in a way that, has compounded or compelled me, to kind of be in touch with what it means to be a man existing, which I'm very intrigued by the topic here mm-hmm. that, prayer is, what was the, I can't remember the exact.
Prayer as the fundamental act of the creature.
So I kind of want to know where we're going with that. I don't want to derail you too much, but.
Well, let's dive into it here.
I will play the role of the naive listener and ask questions.
Yeah, that's good.
We'll pretend that I don't understand the words you're using.
Well, I'm also going to pretend like I understand the words that he's using. Because even I was reading through this and I was like pulling my notes together and I was like, I don't even understand what the hell he's talking about. Yeah. Like, so this is definitely a stretch. What I would like to point out is like, there's kind of a trilogy of podcasts that I've recorded with you, and that have been developing on top of each other. The first was The Geography of the Human Person, which came out in September, which might've been Michonne. I forget.
No, I think we did that one.
Okay. No. And then Man and the Dimension of Gift, which we did together.
Yep.
That was Theology of the Body. Mm-hmm. And then this one. So what all three of these podcasts, the first one, Kenneth Schmitz, The Geography of the Human Person, the second one, which was in October. And again, these are scattered throughout because we rotate through, but this is kind of how my thinking has been. This is a trajectory of my thought that I think, will help to locate this. What is the context of reading Ulrich right now? How is it affecting? Because all of this is playing out in my personal study, in my class course prep, of things like this. And basically, what Schmitz, John Paul II, and Ulrich all have together, these last three podcasts that I've led on, is what we could call the metaphysics of gift.
Yes.
So the idea that at the heart of love is the inner exchange of self gift and reception. Mm. So gift and reception as the inner logic of love, the inner essence of what it means to love. And what they're going to do, all three of them are going to do, is say, that's not just the act of loving. There's an ontology or a metaphysics of love, which is the grounds of reality. So we can go so far as to say, being is gift, being as gift. So seeing in a very analogical way, the inner life of God is this giving and receiving, which is Trinitarian love, and that's the origin and the foundations of creation.
Yeah. Is
the giftedness of and the reception of love.
So is the description of prayer going to be kind of that dialogue with God in which we accept ourselves as gift and then give ourselves back in relationship?
Because
I just, my little diatribe about literature and history, to just close that square, was these kind of contemporary, more modern philosophers, thinkers, psychologists kind of broke what it was to be a human, what human nature was, and kind of everything became skeptical, right? And so I love that we're getting back to an anthropology in your three-part trilogy. So that's kind of what I wanted to close with.
Yeah.
I think we understand intuitively that there is something about humanity that is different from the animals and connected through history. But the way we've been kind of trained to think, we think we're totally separated, isolated individuals who have power over everything in our lives rather than any sort of reception.
Yeah.
So
the gift structure of reality is known, imitated, and participated in by human beings, by rational animals alone. Mm-hmm. We're the only ones who give Christmas gifts.
Yeah.
Like just everybody, like we're trying to humanize these dogs that are everywhere. Everybody's their freaking dog.
Yeah, and, I mean, the dog brings you, dead rabbit.
Yeah, and it's like he doesn't give gifts. He doesn't have language, and he doesn't communicate in a kind of meaningful. But his existence is gift.
Yeah,
and that's what resonates with the human heart. But the problem is we have this innate capacity to know this dog is a gift, he can't or she can't reciprocate the knowledge and enter into that. And so this kind of communion only happens within persons, but that persons exist within the life of God. So this brings us to our topic, which is how do we then locate prayer as what he calls the fundamental act of the creature within a larger metaphysical vision of reality, which we call gift. That's what we're asking. Right. And it's early this morning.
I might need another coffee.
You go for your coffee at any point. And again, I'm just going to grab a couple of, maybe like three of his, basic insights here. He starts the essay off a dangerous reflection on the fundamental act of the creature. So one thing that he's looking at is the notion of creatureliness, which stands at the heart of the, modern problem. Which has rejected the notion of creature of creation, because it implies what dependence, limitation, finitude,
an order that's outside of us.
Exactly. It presumes a creator.
Yep.
And so that's the first thing that has to go. So he's saying, like, what does this look like to no longer repress our creatureliness as moderns and actually start to kind of enter into
this?
I
like that. Repress our creatureliness.
Yeah.
That's a great line. I'm going to chew on that one all day.
Okay, there you go. Well, I'm just pulling it right out of the book here. So, so here's a question. So this is like kind of recovering a sense of creatureliness as the kind of fundamental way we think about life. And again, the beautiful thing about being a creature is that the gift structure of my existence. If I'm self-creating, if I'm self-actualizing, there's no giftedness to that.
Yeah.
What the hallmark of creation is gratuity. It just didn't have to exist. Yeah. And if I can go on this real quick before we, to really make this point, kind of put some flesh on it. On Saturday, I baptized and was the godfather for a baby named Matilda, who is 1 pound and 1 ounce.
Oh, wow.
She was born at 25 weeks. This is the daughter of Anna and Eric Hill. I have never seen a human being so tiny. Hmm. And baptizing her was kind of tricky because she's in the NICU, and just getting the little dropper on there. We had actually a Scotch dropper that her dad, Eric, and I were using. We tried to use it. We're like, this would be cool, but we didn't. We had to use some kind of more surgical thing where the water came in. But this tiny little human being, I just remember looking at her on Saturday and just feeling this deep sense of love for her, not just because I've been entrusted with the care of her soul spiritually, but also just the absolute precious and fragile nature of human life and the total gift of this being that just is there as a person, just tiny, tiny, tiny little person, but completely unique. And again, a soul that's created at the same time. So that when I think about creation and the newness of creatureliness, it's like that's Matilda.
Yeah.
She's sitting right there. All right. So maybe that helps with people to kind of get our sense around why does this matter? So, okay, here we go. First line, in this atmosphere, he's talking about kind of creatureliness here. Creatureliness seems to be a relic of ages past. So this is modernity. When man could not yet find the courage to be himself and engage a world completely left to his discretion. Previously, because of dependencies in which man was enmeshed by his own fault, he had, quote, to give thanks for what he had received. He was forced to speak with another who acted as a benefactor and to reply to the word which was first addressed to him. He was forced to pray. This is the modern vision of what creatureliness is. Let me read this back again. Creatureliness, this, or even metaphysics, atomistic metaphysics, comes from an ancient world that no longer exists, where man didn't have the courage to be himself. This is how modern man thinks of ancient world and Christians, is that this is Nietzsche, right? That's who he's talking to right now. Yeah. Nietzsche is like, you don't have the courage to become the Übermensch because you want to live in this dependence on something that you can't know, namely God. And he says it's enmeshed by his own fault to give thanks. Now that's a reference to Marx, who says, so long as we continue to give thanks to God, to other people, we live the slavery of dependence on others. So the real way forward is to give thanks to no one but yourself for your existence. This is the kind of Marxist Nietzschean thing, which is crazy to think about, but really at the work of self-creation and the culture that we're living in.
I don't know if there's a direct connection to this, but I'm thinking of the Greek mythology of the gods rise up to overthrow the Titans, and then man is warring with the gods. There's always like this me as subject first.
Yeah, there's nothing new here.
And we're rebelling again for our freedom, for our self-expression, our self-creation, that you have to reject that. They would view it as a slavery to pray. It's an obligation that you must do this thing.
Right.
As opposed to, I think where he's going to go, this kind of the radical core of who we are, accepting who we are, is then how we live fully.
So prayer is eradicated. There's no need for prayer when you're operating out of a Marxist or Nietzschean foundation.
Because there's not another.
Because there's not another. And there's no need. There's no need for dependence. So we have to think about self-creation not as an opposing worldview that we have to kind of battle, but as it's the antithesis of prayer. which is really interesting to think about, because a lot of the governing kind of zeitgeist behind progressivism, behind the debates, the political debates, everything that's happening, is rooted in this idea of self-creation. And I think for a long time, I had thought of it as an opposing worldview that was grounded in whatever these kind of presuppositions, but it's just anti-prayer. That's what it's actually anti-prayer when you are redefining reality based on your perception. It's the exact opposite. It's the total undoing of what prayer actually is, which, as he says, and we're moving towards, is the fundamental act of being a creature itself. Mm. So, any thoughts on that?
I just think it's giving me a new category of discernment in my own life, as well as kind of just people around me, when I see tendencies towards self-creation or self-reliance. That's probably a red flag that I'm not praying well, or that another's not praying well. So in like a director mode, it's something for me to think about. But then like on my own examine, be like, oh man, I'm trying to ubermensch everything around me, and I'm trying to save the parish and create myself as priest so-and-so. Oh, maybe I've stopped entering into prayer and following the will of God.
It's very easy to fall into a kind of Christian ubermensch mentality of like, I'm going to kind of make this happen. And then prayer becomes what? Obligation.
It's either one, side an obligation, or two, a hedge of like, hey, here's what I'm doing. God, if you want to help out, if you want to throw some grace at that, if you're there, if you're in. But it's more of like a engaging God for the sake of what I've already kind of self-decided,
right?
Rather than the reception of going to God first. And I mean, you read Intro to Devout Life, you read, you know, any of these saints, and it's like, it's purely this ascending towards God until he just gives to you, and it's the reception, and he's doing the work within you. I see the tendency, quite frankly, in both of us to come up with our own ideas and plans at times.
Yeah.
And then, I think we can be susceptible to the Ubermensch.
Well, I'd appreciate it if you would just speak about yourself here and not be so judgy. No, I totally agree with you.
I must bring others in, because I can't condemn myself alone.
Right. No, I totally agree. I think that there's a moralizing of prayer that happens in Catholic life. And I feel like I just personally am in a place where it's like, I need to like make prayer metaphysical again. I don't know if that's not a MAGA hat. There's something about making prayer metaphysical again. Like it needs to.
Mama? No, Mama.
But I say that because like I need to pray out of my creatureliness again, out of just being, out of waking up and being like the giftedness of reality, the newness of the day, the start, the freshness of the moment. I think Advent lends itself towards this instead of. Prayer is a time when I reflect on how much I've failed and how I got to get my crap together. Otherwise, I'm not going to be loved.
Yeah.
Like this is kind of how we fall into things when we're operating out of that, when we're trying to do the Ubermensch self-reliant mentality, but then we try and pray because they're antithetical of each other.
There's also the functionizing or almost the obligatory nature of prayer at times that I'll go to my director and be like, man, I just really feel like I'm failing at prayer. I haven't been praying well, or I haven't been praying enough. And they're like, well, what do you mean by that? And I said, well, I've got to do it. And it's like an obligation rather than the fount of like life.
Yeah.
It's, oh, I'm failing at this because here's another task that God has given me and I've got to do it. And I've with the companion. So I've got to do my holy hour and I've got to do the liturgy of the hours because I promised that to the bishop. And now it's just this list of obligations rather than the place of encounter with the source of life, with the source of being, where I receive my life from anew every day.
And that's the question is like, how do we have obligations in prayer? You and I need to say mass today. We need to pray the liturgy of the hours. We have a plan of life that we're committed to. So how do you check all the boxes, but how do you make prayer more like an atmosphere that you live in instead of a checklist of things that you got to go through? And that's part of this kind of making prayer more metaphysical and thinking more deeply about prayer as arising out of, as the fundamental act of it's the basic thing that I do as a creature. And if I'm not denying that in some kind of Marxist or Nietzschean framework, then this is the most natural thing that I would ever do is pray. That's what Ulrich is saying here. It's like, it's the fundamental act. Yeah. The most basic, simple thing is to pray. And that is, and I think that even to go back to Matilda for a second, like, what is she doing? Like, she, her being, her prayer is just her being. She's a baptized soul, yeah, giving glory to God, sitting in this tiny, tiny NICU incubator, trying to grow, mm-hmm, trying to live with a body that could actually actualize the potency of her rational existence. And that's prayer in a fundamental creaturely way. Yeah. To think about it.
The being.
Yeah. So anyways, here's a crazy line for you that you might have heard before, but I think it's worth reading in light of what we're talking about. How modernity and the architects of especially the postmodern world really want to destroy and eradicate prayer. And the way you do that is you eradicate creatureliness. So here's the line. This is it's a few lines. The wretchedness of religion is at once an expression and a protest against real wretchedness. Religion is the sigh of an oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions. This protest, however, melts away in futility because it begins beyond the world. It is situated in a sphere which, as such, already constitutes a product of alienation. All right, you can hear, who does this sound like? Every protest which erupts from this region, therefore, only consolidates the weakness of the world's dimensions. This prayer is bound to remain fruitless because it is rooted in inhuman presuppositions which enable it and thus make it ongoing influence felt so long as man does not desist from his form of rebellion. Okay, we need to replace prayer with work.
Is this Marx?
Karl Marx.
Yeah.
Gronsky used to quote this line a lot. Religion is the heart of a heartless world. So there's Marx is acknowledging something here to say that there's a reason why people are innately religious. But the problem is you're not escaping the dependency that which is alienation, right? Because in that religious act of acknowledging I am not God, therefore I am from God, I'm bound and enslaved to a relationship of dependency, which is alienation, and the only way to work out of that is this kind of ethos of self-creation. But I just think that is just a very striking. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, mm-hmm, the soul of soulless conditions. It's like, wow.
What's interesting,
he's hitting something real there.
It seems like the modern world is grappling with the reality of original sin without wanting to acknowledge sin in any capacity, really. He's pointing out a reality that, like, in sin, we, in a sense, are heartless and soulless and need something. But the Catholic, we talked about this in the one on theology of the body, the Catholic anthropology begins before sin.
Yeah.
Man was created before he sinned. And there's a purpose for man, a relationship, a personhood of man and woman before sin. And a lot of times I think we're trying to do our anthropology merely from the other side of original sin, rather than looking at any context of eschatology with the coming of Christ and our now beatific supernatural end as a possibility, or the protology before the fall. We're only looking at man as affected by sin.
Yeah.
And then we're trying to build out a universal understanding of the universe in that context. And I think that's where a lot of these errors come from, because they make real assessments of observations in the world of how people act and interact. And yet they miss the mark, which is sin, hamartia.
Yeah.
they miss literally the mark of what man is, because they're saying man is kind of by nature his sinfulness.
He's naughty by nature. Do you know that from the 90s? No, I'm just
naughty
joking.
By
yeah, no. That's it. It's the presupposition that man is enslaved in the kind of context of original sin, and that our task is to eradicate that structure. But there's no sense of an anthropology of a goodness of creation, of an order of things that were distorted by sin. So I totally agree.
Which is fascinating, because then the response is a utopian response. If we need to build a utopia, so Marxism is a utopian philosophy that if we get the system right, and you just kind of, in a sense, give over your freedom to the state, everybody will be taken care of. It'll be happy. We won't, you know.
And it's all in the future.
Yeah.
It's always revolution now for the future, for the future, for the future. Yeah. So, okay. So that's the first point. And I got to get moving here because we're running out of time. I have class. Yeah. So that's the first point is to say prayer is the fundamental act of the creature. We cannot repress our creatureliness and pray at the same time because to do that is in contradiction. So we have to acknowledge that. And again, I would just, the final point on this is to say, think of creation as something that is ongoing. God is creating today. Mm-hmm. Like today is a work of creation. Grace is a work of new creation. It's not just this kind of static thing that happened 6 billion years ago where God just kind of created and then everything just kind of has been sitting in its kind of semi-autonomous evolutionary pattern. And we just happen to be kind of these rando protagonists that are kind of walking around an urbanized modern world to kind of figure out meaning. That's not what we're about. It's God is actively creating today and he's creating in my soul. So just to keep that before us. Okay, second point here. The fundamental act of prayer put to the test and the form of pure finitude. What he's talking about here is poverty, wealth and poverty, this kind of dynamic that's at play in prayer. And I just want to grab one line from it, which is a beautiful one here. So he says, asking about creation means looking away from oneself. The only one disposed to ask this question is the selfless one who has raised the bastions of the ego that clings to itself without himself managing the demolition squad. So what is Ulrich going to go after here? Navel gazing in prayer. So it's one thing to be like, I'm a creature. I need to open my heart to the creator who is actively working right now, who I utterly am in dependence on, who I can never really fully know. But that impoverishes me. And the point of prayer is not to evaluate self-evaluation and then get better results as a Christian, you know, functioning. So he says this. Prayer is adventure, a voyage on the high seas. It renounces all ties to the secure shore. This is like seashells by the seashore. To the secure shore of seductive, self-possessive power, which warns us against the unprotectedness and weakens our arms at the raising of the sails. Okay, so why do we resist prayer? Why are we slow to pray? Why are we so awkward in it? It's not just because we don't have time. It's because prayer makes us experience our poverty. Like there's nothing we fail at more than prayer in terms of like, if you were evaluating your life, I mean,
absolutely.
There's nothing.
I just had fraternal group yesterday. I talked about,
where you're just like, and it's not just failure of like, I didn't
the
make
time
it the time and things, but it's just when you're actually in it, what does it even mean to pray? It's like, it's the most impoverished basic. It's so fundamental that it's almost like we don't even understand how to do it. What does that look like? I mean, I have been so distracted mentally in prayer and I don't even know, am I just regressing and I'm actually a more distracted, more kind of fragmented person? Or am I just more aware that I've always been this insane and I've always been thinking about random things in prayer? And I don't know. I have no way of knowing.
Am I climbing the mountain? Am I tumbling down? I don't know. I've been thinking as you've been talking of the kind of natural impulses of prayer in man. And the two that keep coming to mind are when a tragedy hits or something that is just clearly out of our control happens, we move towards prayer, kind of on a natural level. We're interceding, we're beseeching help from some power outside of us because the storm is coming towards me and I have no control over it. The fire is raging towards my house and I don't know if my house is going to survive. Like these are the things where we are, our power fails and we start to reach out. But there's this impulse to prayer and you still even see it where, I mean, now it's the thoughts and prayers are with you type of like Facebook posts, but there's still at least that impulse of like, this is something bigger than you can control, I can control. So I've got to like, we've got to move outside of ourselves in a sense in intercession. And then the other one, the kind of the counterpoint, but an impulse to prayer is just that overwhelming sense of gratitude for life, for beauty. I mean, it's when you're struck by the sunset, when you are driving through the mountains, when you see, you know, this newborn baby, when, you know, you experience, memory from your past come up, and there's just this innate sense of gratitude for this moment.
Yeah.
That itself is prayer too. So there's the Thanksgiving, the spontaneous Thanksgiving, and then the spontaneous reaching out to some sort of power beyond us for help in the face of total helplessness. Our human, I mean, that's built in. Everybody's had those experiences, and those are prayer.
Or at least
the beginnings of prayer.
I totally agree. And I think that we're not trying to untether the concept of prayer from formula, because Christ gives us a formula to pray. They said, teach us how to pray. Yeah. They go to Christ, and they teach us how to pray. He says, pray the Our Father.
Yeah.
He gives us. So we cling to the words of Christ and to the scriptures, like with desperate, but prayer is something like, when we think of it in this kind of atmospheric sense, like you're saying, like these kind of movements, these gestures, these kind of moments that are kind of noumenal, that are oftentimes rooted in the experience of suffering. I mean, I buried a child. I had the baptizing Matilda, 25 weeks, and then I buried a child that died in the womb at 37 weeks last week. Hmm. So I was simultaneously shattered by the sadness and the poverty of human life, and filled with an immense sense of the wealth of God by the giftedness and the grace and just watching what He was doing in the midst of the Calvary and real uncertainty and confusion. So that's and those are moments that come and go, and are we living attentive to them? You know, that's the kind of prayer that we have to, as this fundamental act of the creature, that's what we got to kind of get back down to. It doesn't mean we don't pray our holy hour, liturgy hours, or a rosary, whatever, but also be aware of like those moments.
Yeah, we don't want to go like, oh, my existence is prayer, and so now I do nothing.
Right.
I think the catechism begins with the quote from St. Teresa of Lisieux that prayer is like for a moment, I turn my heart to God and realize that I'm in His presence and He's watching over me or something. I don't know the exact quote, but
it's a sigh of the heart, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should probably look that up.
Give us a fact check there. But I just, what I want to just point out is that impulse. There's an impulse to prayer. And then the Our Father, if you extrapolate it, it's like Our Father who art in heaven, we're acknowledging the Creator. We're acknowledging our creatureliness. That's the first move of the Our Father, that He is Creator. Give us this day our daily bread. We're dependent on You. We need You. I mean, you go through, we could have kind of these innate experiences that we have, I think, are encompassed in those words.
Yeah. And I think, so what is keeping us from that kind of deeper prayer, this kind of these moments of this kind of existential, more creaturely prayer? This is what he says. He says, you got to be ready to set out on the adventure, the voyage of the high seas, and to renounce all ties to the secure shore of seductive self-possessive power. Hmm. So prayer is going to render us powerless. And you're going to feel that. And this is why prayer is so consoling in the midst of the cross, because you're already powerless. So when you're praying, and when you're praying with people, intercession and compassion, compassio, entering into the suffering with the other, which is a deep form of prayer, is why is that consoling to the person? Because they're already experiencing the powerlessness of death. And prayer is the way of acknowledging, interiorizing that, and then drawing meaning from what Christ suffered. I show up at the hospital, the baby's dead, 37 weeks. What are you to say? There's nothing that can be said. There's literally nothing. Their life is shattered. They're never going to recover from this moment. But somehow you have to be in the midst of that as a priest or as a friend or as a spouse. And you have to move through that. The temptation is power. The seductive, self-possessive nature of power, which is, I want control of this. I want to eradicate the poverty. I want to adorn myself with the wealth of knowledge, of security, of comfort, of well-being, or whatever it is. Just get me away from this experience of powerlessness. And the life of prayer will not ever permit that, because you're letting go of the shore, so to speak. So Ulrich has a lot to say about poverty and prayer, and we're going
to
keep moving.
Go to our third
final point here. What are we at for time here?
48.
Okay. I'm going to wrap this
6
up.
6 minutes.
Wrap this up very quickly. The fundamental act of the creature, prayer as Thanksgiving. So this is a nice thing, as it's Thanksgiving weekend and we all love being together with our family for a couple hours and then we drive each other crazy. But this is just a beautiful line. We'll just close it. We don't even need to unpack it. The praying person brings no fruit other than the Eucharistia of love. Prayer is the living flame of the unity of the gift, which descends as gift to self and ascends as gift of self, so that the flame spreads out in every direction like a burnt offering, but does not fall back upon itself because it is fed by the love that does not seek its own. So what is he saying here is the Eucharistic love of Christ is the self-giving of Christ to the church. It's the self-surrendered love of the cross of Christ pouring himself out for the church, which is rooted in his inner Trinitarian reception of the Father's gift-giving. The Father is the initiating generativity of all of reality and the Godhead itself, and he pours forth himself so completely into the Son that the Son, in receiving that, then pours forth himself. And the gift of that self-gift of Christ in creation we call Eucharist. That's Thanksgiving for the Christian, and that's entering into that is the life of prayer. The fundamental act of the creature is not just this kind of metaphysical being out there and mm-hmm. kind of thinking more deeply, but it's really about entering into the logic of gratitude is reception in the order of self-gift. That's it.
And that's it. Even etymologically, Eucharist, Eucharistia is the giving thanks, Thanksgiving action. And if we talk about the Eucharist being the source and summit of the Christian life, we're back to prayer, Thanksgiving, Eucharistia, reception, creatureliness, all tied into that one, you know, principal act of Christ.
Yeah. So I think we'll stop there.
Sounds good.
We could go on and on and on and on, but prayer is the fundamental act of the creature. Hope this is interesting. Hope it helps. We're not trying to demoralize in the true sense of it your prayer. Your prayer is still a moral act, so please keep praying. And pray the Our Father. We're not saying just kind of bliss out in this kind of, you know, postmodern ethos, but think of prayer as an atmosphere. Think of it, and also like just coming full circle while we're talking about atmospheres and weather. It was 28 degrees this morning at 5:30, felt like 9. So perception of prayer and the actual reality of prayer are different. You just don't get to know necessarily where it's at. All right. So shout outs, and then we'll wrap it up and head into Advent here.
I have one shout out from a focus missionary at University of Denver. Lance Sprecher, I believe is his name. Lance Sprecher. He's a listener, CSYSK listener. Focus missionary at DU. So he met my mom, as many people do, and he heard her name. He's like, wait, are you Jacob, Father Jacob's mom? And she's like, yeah. She's like, oh, I listen to the podcast. So Lance, thanks for listening. Thanks for your work.
That's great.
At DU.
We were talking earlier about some of our friends who refuse to listen to podcasts of friends, but then we have other friends who do listen. And I heard from Skylar York, now she's Skylar Smith, out in Nashville, and got a just wonderful reconnected with her. She was one of my college students way back in the day. I don't know if you ever knew Skylar and Leslie. They were friends, focus missionaries after that, and just great women. So Skylar, great to hear from you, and thanks for listening to the podcast. And then I got to hang out with Thor, which was awesome. And that's a whole nother fantastic story for another time. But Thor Chester at Right Proper Brewing.
Yeah, you got out there quick, man. You got an offer to go get some free beer, and you flew across the country.
I literally did. It was a very providential meeting, and I was very, very edified and blessed by meeting him. So we love hearing from you on the podcast, and moments like that are just, we're so grateful that the Lord works and to connect us with those who listen. So that's it. Happy Thanksgiving and blessed Advent to you. We will be recording in a few days with all the boys, which is always a ruckus. And we'll get that out in a few weeks.
Yeah. Take care. Have a good Thanksgiving, and God bless you all.
All right. Safe travels back to Glenwood. CatholicStuffPodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening.